Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck nicks, what the fucksters, what the fuckeristas, what the fuckstables? All right, that's fucking enough. Sorry, kids. Sorry, parents. That's a lot of fucks in the first 5 or 10 seconds of this show. It's full fucking on. I apologize. It's Mark Maron. This is WTF. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy my show. What have I got to tell you right out of the gate? Well, if you listen to that pre-show announcement, I think we answered everyone's questions. For those dates where I hit those amphitheaters where some of you thought I was playing myself, flattered, as I said, but not true, it seems that the tickets for the Oddball Comedy and Curiosity Festival, of which I will be part of on some of those dates, go on sale Saturday at LiveNation.com. So those would be the ones I'm on. Those would be the ones in Tampa and all those other ones. Why don't you have your website up, man? Maybe that'd be helpful for people to listen to you say the things that you want them to go see and maybe be part of if you had the dates in front of you. Don't talk to me like that. Don't sass me. I'm just trying to help. Who the fuck are you? I'm you, asshole. All right, this has been fun. We should be a comedy team. All right, well, let's go to the calendar. Let's go to the calendar now. Tonight, I am in Bloomington, Indiana at the Comedy Attic. Tomorrow I'll be there too and Saturday. And then the oddball dates are Tampa, Florida, Charlotte, North Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia. Then I'm back in Charlotte at the Comedy Zone. And then I'm at Red Rocks in Denver for the oddball. I'll be at Mountain View, California, Irvine, Dallas, Houston, and Austin. So those all go on sale Saturday. That's my understanding at LiveNation.com. Glad we settled that. All right, today on the show, from the new film, I don't say that too often, but you know him from a lot of things. But he is in Think Like a Man 2. Romany Malco, maybe some of you know him from Think Like a Man, the first one, or some of you know him from 40-Year-Old Virgin. That's where I know him from. I ran into him on a plane, and I was like, you're that guy. He's like, holy shit, I love your show. And I'm like, you're on it. Let's do it. He's on the show today, and I'll tell you, man, I didn't know what to expect, but it was full on. It was a full on conversation about a lot of shit. I learned a lot about rap music that I didn't know I was going to learn. We learned a little bit about politics, a little bit about the black man in politics, according to Romany Malco. We learned, what else did we learn? We learned about acting. We learned about fishing. We learned about Trinidad. We learned about the Marines. I don't want to spoil anything. I feel like I've spoiled a lot already. Great guy. Great talk. Coming up around the bend. That was a really out of tune opening riff to Up Around the Bend by Creedence Clearwater Revival. Thank you. Thank you to those who were able to identify that. I appreciate that. Another thing I want to mention is that my buddy Bill Schecht, he's a writer, and he was a writer on Letterman for like 25 years. He used to do, there's an interesting story about Schecht, and you'll hear that story on a future WTF, but he's got a book that's dropping this week. It's called Shrink Thyself. It's a novel about getting rid of psychotherapy and living the unexamined life. You can get that at Amazon.com. You can get that now. That's Bill Schecht's book, and he will be on WTF soon. That was a great conversation. I'm trying to figure out whether or not I'm close enough to you guys to tell you this thing about my dick. Because I'm not that kind of guy. That's not really true. I mean, I've shared things about my dick before, but not so specifically. Let me think about it. Right now, I'd like to share with you a little something, because I'm telling you what I'm doing right now. I'm breaking in a new pair of pants, and I know some of you who follow me know that that's a big deal, breaking in some pants. And you're like, what kind of pants, Mark? Well, they're black jeans, classic black selvage jeans. Where'd you get those? Are those Emma Jean Willys? No, you know why? They're not, because the pocket on the ass of my Emma Jean Willys went out. You know, it blew out. I blew out the pocket from driving too hard on my walking and sitting on stools. from sitting on stools with my wallet in my back pocket. This is a stand-up related wear and tear of my ass pocket and my jeans. My wallet kept falling out. Fell out on stage in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It was incredibly distracting to a good deal of the audience. I lost about 10 minutes of good material because people were wondering when I would notice my wallet was on the floor. Can't have that happen. That's a professional liability to have an ass pocket blowout where your wallet can fall out and just capture the imaginations of an entire audience of adults. Can't have that happen too often. So I call Imogene and Willie. I email them. I say, what's up? You know, you guys are a special pant. You made these pants. What do I got to do to get the blowout in my ass pocket fixed? They said, send them out here. Wash them first, please. Don't sell us your stinky ball jeans. Wash them, and we'll fix it in three to 4 weeks. Went 3 to 4 weeks. I need to get this ass back up on a stool before then. You can't have my pants up on the lift for that long. How long does it take to fix an ass pocket? So I decided to poke around the internet, and I look up Denim Repair Los Angeles. I figure there's got to be some specialty operation. And sure enough, I come up with this place called Schaefer's Garment Hotel, and I'm like, what up with that? Got some good Yelp reviews. This guy seems like a denim genius. So I go over there, and I show him the blowout in my ass pocket on the Imogene Willies. We talk selvage for a little while, and then I talk about Billy Gibbons, and I turn him on to my show. This cat's a good cat. I think his name's Robert. He says, yeah, I can fix that blowout in your ass pocket probably inside 10 days. It's going to cost a little bit. How much could it cost? I don't buy much, folks. Let me get my ass pocket blowout fixed for what seems to be an exorbitant amount of money. Some of you are like, I would have sewn it myself. Yeah, but this guy's a specialist. Got to give it to the doctors. You know, if you got a problem, you go to a specialist. So I gave it to Robert over there at Schaefer's Garment Hotel. Turns out he's making his own pants over there. He's got some selvedge denim jeans, classic style. He's got some indigo denim. He's got some classic black denim, heavyweight black denim. And I'm like, holy fuck, look at those. I haven't seen those in a while. He's like, yeah, we make them right here. I get that denim from Japan. Feel it. I'm feeling it. Hell yeah. Bring it. Let's get some of them pants. I didn't know you were making pants over here, Robert. He's like, yeah, man, we make real pants. And he's got a guy that makes hats over there. He's got a couple of dogs that hang out and some guitars. How does all of a sudden the image that I've been sort of doing, you know, without knowing anything, there's a whole store for it? I'm not a hat guy, but I'm a guitar guy, not a dog guy, but I can appreciate a dog in a store, especially one that sells denim and boots and shit. But I don't buy them like, you know, broken in. These are fresh denims. They're stiff, and I'm in them right now. And I'm waiting for my ass pocket blowout to be fixed. So I'm going out of town. I'll be at Bloomington showcasing my unbroken in black denim pants. I set up the dick thing. I should probably go into the dick thing. Is that okay? Kids, step out. So, you know, I had this woman over and I had a minor tragedy in the bathroom. And it was a tough call what to do, but it was okay. I have never had the type of STD that would create a sore on your schlong, on your junk, as the kids say. Never had a sore on my junk, okay? I never got that dirty or stuck my thing into the wrong place. So here's what I'm doing. All right, I don't know. This bathroom humor, literally, if it's even humor, it's just a story that I don't even know why I feel compelled to share it with you, but I seem to be in it. I seem to be doing it. Okay, all right, this is embarrassing, but why is that? It's never stopped me before. So I got this girl over, and I don't know her that well, and she's younger than me, and she's clean and pretty. And, you know, sometimes smells are not to be shared until later, and sometimes you don't even want to let on that you do that, even though I talk about it. It was something I just had to stifle that. So I'm in the bathroom, I do my business, I figure I'll be polite, I'm going to light a match, so I had some wooden matches on the on the back of the toilet there. So I'm sitting on the toilet. I light the match. I wave it out. And then I go to put the match out in the toilet between my legs. And I stick the smoldering ember of the tip of the match right on to the top of my dick. And I branded it. This was not a good situation. I had another day with this person. And now I've got something that is going to appear much like a shanker of some kind on the head of my tool. So now I got to cop to this. I got to walk out of the bathroom and go, I just stuck a hot match onto my cock. And that's something you and I are going to have to deal with. And I'm willing to sort of write it out. I'll be fine, but I need you to know that's what that is. So be careful, I guess what I'm saying. Sometimes politeness can burn your dick. Is that the moral to extrapolate from that? Is that where we go from there? I'm ashamed that I shared that story. It's going to be fine. It's getting better. Thank you for asking. Right now, I am more than pleased to share with you now my conversation with Romney Malco. Had a great time, and I had no idea I was going to have as good a time as I had, but he's a live wire. He's a good.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Cat.
I did this interview for this magazine. I'm not going to say their names because they don't deserve it.
Uh-huh.
But the headline that they chose to use completely out of context.
Yeah.
I was like, what the fuck?
What was the headline?
I'm like, then I just realized it's this lowest common denominator, man.
Of course.
They wrote a letter of apology saying we were just trying to, you know, attract readers and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's like, what good's the apology? The shit is out there.
Thank you. Thank
right? you. I mean, you know, it's like, I appreciate you apologize, but could you now take it out of everyone's head?
Thank you. I fucking agree. Exactly. And then now there's this association with me being this way. I'm like, fuck these people.
What way? Man. What happened? Come on.
Oh, man.
What?
There's... I don't know.
You don't have to mention the magazine. What was it? What?
It's implying that somehow or the other I had to get back to black people. Like, the fuck?
What do you mean get
when
back?
When the fuck did I ever leave? When did I stop being black? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so anyway, it was hilarious and demeaning.
Get back to black people.
Yeah. Like,
what was that based on? Like, because that interests me that when somehow or another someone decides, like, you've turned your back. On your black.
Yeah. Like me? Me?
Out of all people.
Literally with my Tijuana Jackson and all this other stuff. And anyway, I just laughed at it. But they were like, we were just trying to, you know, we realized it was a major oversight. We've corrected the issue, blah, blah, blah.
Well, we realized it's a major oversight. You're still black and it's okay.
Literally. And from that point forward, I just like, okay, I just won't be fucking with these people. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, I think because of the fact that I started in mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
Starting in mainstream.
What does that mean? White?
You know what?
Well,
I don't know because...
What would you say the beginning... Like, it's 40-year-old virgin was a big break for you.
That was a huge break for me. 40-year-old virgin.
Is that what you...
Break.
Would you consider that was when you were arrived... where people knew you.
Yeah.
That's where I know you from.
Yeah. 40-year-old virgin.
But you were around a long time before that.
Yeah, I was around for a bit, you know, and I hadn't really been doing big stuff. Like, the things I got to work with I got to work with, like, Vince Vaughn early in the game on a project called The Prime Gig.
But where'd you come from? Let's go back, because I go back.
Okay.
I'm willing to go back with you.
I know. Dude, I'm a listener. I'm an avid listener. I know.
No, I'm prepared.
I was just talking to Ashley about, she's like, I was looking for the cats, and I was talking to Ashley, and she was like,
they're in the bedroom. I'll show you.
Yeah. She said, they don't come out much, and I was like, well, I think they came out when Cranston was on. They might have paid a visit. Well, I think it was when Cranston was on. I could be wrong.
Yeah, well, he might have seen him. I'll show you the cats after.
Okay.
But what kind of name is Romney Malco?
It's a gypsy name.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Why do you get a gypsy name?
Because, you know, my family's Trinidadian and Venezuelan.
Uh-huh.
And in Trinidad, we have a lot of East Indians. And in, you know, I could be wrong about this, but just in Trinidad, being that, you know, the East Indian culture is so common.
Yeah.
My name isn't that far-fetched, you know
right,
what I mean?
Right, right, right.
Like, probably the most spoken language in Trinidad is Bengali, which is like a dialect of, you know,
of Indian?
Indian dialect.
Have you spent time in Trinidad?
Plenty. I went to school in Trinidad off and on as a kid.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so I have family from Venezuela, like Maracas in Venezuela, and then I have family from like San Fernando, Point 410, all over the place, Los Hero, all over the place in Trinidad.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and both my parents met in Brooklyn, but they were both Trinidadians. My mom came from Trinidad to compete. She was Mrs. She won Mrs. Universe.
I mean, oh, really?
She, no, she won Mrs. Trinidad and Tobago and came here to compete. And my dad had come here because University of New York University.
NYU.
Yeah, NYU was very interested in my pops.
For?
He was already an established surveyor and engineer.
So the it's a specific type of background, but is it, it's not mostly Spanish. It's a mix, right?
It's like similar. I guess I had a place in Brazil, and I found Brazil to be very similar.
You had
too.
A place in Brazil?
Yeah, on the northeast coast of Bahia.
Why'd you just get a place in Brazil? You just felt like it?
You know what? One, it was, I'm really into fishing. I'm really into fishing. And I found the place that sat between these two huge, this town that sat between two huge rivers.
Uh-huh.
And right above a town called Recife, Recife, R-E-C-I-P-H-E or uh-huh. something like that. But Recife sits right above... Is the billfish capital of the world.
Billfish.
Yeah. So, you know.
And that's a good fish?
That's a good fish. It's
you're talking like, you know, like I should know. A billfish.
Well, a billfish, right. It's a pretty prestigious game fish. And, you know, you see the ones, they have the big long thing
on
the front of them.
A marlin. That's a marlin.
Like a marlin, yes.
So it's like a marlin.
Yes.
So you're a game fisherman.
I love game fishing.
You go out on a boat and you wrestle the fish.
Well, now I go out on a kayak.
You're stripping it down. You're getting primitive.
Primitive. I like it. You even out the playing field when you do that.
But aren't you talking about fish that are as big as a kayak?
Yep, absolutely. You want to be pulled around. If you ain't being pulled around, you ain't really, you know.
So you're out there with a kayak and a fishing pole that mm-hmm. that locks into your kayak, mm-hmm. trying to catch fish that can pull your shit.
Yep. That's right.
And then you just wrestle it out until it gives up.
Well, it's dope.
And then what do you do with the fish?
Well, then it depends. So I'm a catch and release guy. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Now, I caught like a 40-pound white sea bass, and his ass got eight.
Where'd you get that? Oh, yeah. Well,
off the coast of Santa Barbara.
A white sea bass off the coast of Santa Barbara? Barbara. Right up here?
Right up here.
Is that normal?
There's a season for them. There's a season for them. And you know, if you can get your line, there's a season where if you can get your line down past the barracuda, you know, the sea bass are below them. Yeah. You know, because they're all feeding on like the bait
so
fish.
So there's barracuda off of Santa Barbara?
Oh man, I've caught so many barracuda off of
how
Santa
big?
Barbara because of my nerves.
Anywhere, how many feet?
How many feet? Three feet.
3 feet three barracudas. Feet, all,
4 feet.
Yeah. All teeth.
All teeth. Sometimes you can't get them in the boat because a mako shark will just eat that before you can get.
Wait,
you know.
So you're pulling a barracuda in, and then a mako shark just jumps in up and eats your fish?
Absolutely,
you see that regularly.
Absolutely,
that's a common problem with trying to get past barracuda, hooking a barracuda by accident. You have to deal with a shark that's going to come eat the barracuda.
That's right.
You were definitely in the food chain.
Yes, exactly. You know what I'm saying?
Just a little bigger shark will come take you off the boat.
The last time I saw, I would say it was about a 7 or 8 foot mako shark. The last time I saw a shark in Santa Barbara, I had put my rod down to help a friend, and a fish pulled my rod into the water, and it was a brand new reel. I jumped off the boat, swam down after my reel. I could just see this little gold spool disappearing, and I came back, got on the boat, and about 10 minutes later, a mako shark just started circling the boat. I was like, that's the last. It looks like the, up close, it looks like the pit bull of sharks.
And was that the fucker that ate your reel?
No. There was a guy on the end of the boat who was throwing up the whole time. And his rod somehow.
So he was sort of involuntarily chumming.
Exactly. And he hooked my line and ended up catching my rod 2 hours later.
So you got the rod back.
Got the rod back with a mackerel on it.
So you grew up partially in Trinidad till how old?
Yeah, till I was 13.
So you went through a lot of stuff there.
Yeah, definitely.
Is that where you learned to love fishing?
You know what? Actually, I learned to love fishing in upstate New York. Yeah, because my pops would drive us out from Queens or from Brooklyn to upstate New York on the weekends or every couple weekends, take all the kids in the neighborhood when I was really young.
So your dad was an engineer and a surveyor in Trinidad. Did he get a full ride at NYU, or he didn't take it?
My dad did not take the full ride at NYU. My dad just basically literally went from that to becoming a laborer. And he eventually worked his way up working construction here
right.
to becoming like a foreman and a superintendent. But prior to that, my dad literally, he had this gripe. He's like, a black man will never be recognized for his skills in America. That's how we felt.
But why didn't he take the college gig?
If I could be 100% frank, I believe that, you know, a huge portion of my father's upbringing was in this weird way, like this conditioning, this constant invalidation of, you know, of him and his abilities. And as a result of that, his insecurities overrode his actual ability.
He didn't think he could cut it.
He didn't think it. He always,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I definitely have adopted some of those, you know.
Hard not to.
Yeah.
You have siblings?
I have one younger brother.
Yeah.
I mean, my dad's got like 13 kids, supposedly. I've met five. You know, for like...
We're in Trinidad?
In Trinidad, yeah.
I imagine that shit stopped once he got stateside, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, once he got stateside, he had me and he fell in love with my mom, and he had my brother.
They met in New York.
Brooklyn Basement Party, yeah.
At Brooklyn, and your mom was a former beauty queen,
yep,
from Trinidad.
Yep.
So it all worked out.
Yeah, that's how she got here. She won the trip to America to come compete in America.
And she didn't leave?
No, sir. She got pregnant with me.
And your dad was already a citizen?
My dad was, I think they were both working on the citizenship. They were both about 23 years old.
Wow. Yeah. So where do you get time to have another 12 kids? Was that after?
That was before.
Before?
Yeah, it was before.
So from 15 up, you just...
It's weird. I got siblings. Like, I've met Donna, Debbie, Clint. I mean, these people, like, we've hung a lot, and they're just a few years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, my pops was a wild one, yeah. Unfortunately.
Before you left Trinidad.
Yeah, yes.
And they're down there, all your siblings, your half-siblings?
They're down there. They are in Trini. I used to kick it with Debbie. Debbie was one of my sisters, but I kick it with Donna a lot. Donna is the one that was closest to my pops.
So, okay, so you grow up in New York City.
Yeah.
And what do you do? What's your interest when you're a kid?
When I was a kid,
I mean, how'd you get to acting?
I want to play professional baseball. And I want to be an oceanographer.
So you want to get into baseball? Were you playing?
Yeah, like playing Little League, the whole deal.
So it was a childhood fantasy. It wasn't like you were on the cusp.
No, I moved to Texas when I was like, you know, I left Trinidad at 13, moved to Texas.
With your folks?
With my dad. My parents, it's a long story, but basically my parents separated.
When she found out about the 12 kids?
Oh, no. She got pregnant because she found out about the kids.
Got it.
She
was I'm going to hold on to this.
Oh!
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Because my dad was like, we don't have to have children. I have 13 children. And my mom was like,
23-year-old, 24-year-old.
Like, hell you do. Mm. And she insisted on getting pregnant. And she told me this story about she couldn't get pregnant. And she found this thing called Lydia Pinkham.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I drank that Lydia Pinkham and I was pregnant instantly. And I thought, Mom, I got to research this thing now. And yeah. I researched it, and it's the worst thing you could ever take for yourself.
What is it?
Lydia Pinkham was like this kind of hoax. I mean, it was basically a hoax back in the day that this woman sold, which was like a baby in a bottle. That was the logo. Uh-huh. That was the slogan. If you take this thing, you know, it helps you get pregnant.
Uh-huh.
Kind of like today, if a woman can't get pregnant, she can get acupuncture. There's all these holistic things she can do.
Right.
Lydia Pinkham kind of marketed herself that way back in the day, but it was just really, I read the ingredients and researched the ingredients in it. Woo!
Was it nothing or was it bad?
It was bad.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really tough on the liver. Stuff that was really tough on the liver.
So, but she ended up having two kids.
She ended up having
And then your parents split up.
And then they split up when I was about 12. Yeah, 12.
Mm.
Yeah.
But you were okay with both of them? Were they okay with each other? Was it volatile?
Did
your dad kidnap you and take you to Texas?
I did the kidnapping, actually, believe it or not. Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, what happened was, I'm telling a lot, but my dad... you know, my dad, he messed around.
Clearly he had an issue with
that. Exactly. And so my mother, who was this beauty queen and really sheltered, didn't really have any life skills. She thought she was going to live happily ever after with Prince Charming. Mm. And her method of retaliation.
That was a lack of foresight, I have to say.
I agree. Voila! Yo, this is funny as shit, but it's so true. Yeah. And, you know, anyway, so she kind of, her way of dealing with it, coping, was doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, her and my dad went their separate ways, and she left with a guy who I thought was a drug dealer at the time,
mm-hmm.
and she upped and basically disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I kind of resented that.
So she left. She got pissed at your old man, then
and left. Yeah, and so my dad tracked her down. This is all within weeks. My dad tracks her down.
Yeah,
and when he tracked her down. She kidnapped my brother and I.
Yeah.
And when she kidnapped my brother and I was always closer to my mother, but because of the fact that she was with this guy who I thought was a drug dealer, I didn't want my younger brother, who was 5 years younger than me, in that environment. So I actually kidnapped my brother
At 12,
and escaped to, we were in Hempstead, and managed to escape, managed to get in front of a guy named Detective Howie.
You went to the cops?
I didn't go to the cops. We busted into a dispatch.
Yeah.
They thought we were robbing the place, and I told them what the situation was, and they called the cops. And I didn't want to go with the cops either. Didn't trust cops. You're a young black man in New York. You don't trust the cops. And I ended up sitting across from a guy named Detective Howie, and he really listened to me.
Yeah.
And he knew that I was trying to escape the precinct. He knew I was trying to get out of the precinct.
Yeah.
And so he really stopped, took a moment to assure me that, yo, I'm going to give you what you want. You just have to tell me what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I explained to him what the situation was, but I didn't want to tell him my mom and tell her that she was with this guy who was a drug dealer. I didn't want to tell him that.
Was he a drug dealer?
Yeah. All yeah. Right. My mom was so naive. She's like, really? I didn't know. I'm like, he was, all right. I'd be walking down the street and just run into Neil.
Yeah.
I'm like, what up, Neil?
What are you doing out here?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I sat with Detective Howie and my dad had a friend who was a correctional officer, and they were able to track him down, and he actually, and then within like a day, we had fled to the Caribbean.
With your dad?
With my dad.
But your dad didn't know where you were. Your mom took you, and he didn't know where you were.
He had no clue.
So this was like, you had to get out, find somebody going to find your dad.
Yep.
And then you went to Trinidad. And you just holed up for a while.
I was there from the age of 12 to 13.
And then who the hell decided Texas?
Well, my dad had already been going. Part of the reason he was able to have these affairs is because all this time he'd been working in Texas, because construction was like a big thing. The oil was big in Texas at the time.
So he was working on oil rigs?
Yeah, building oil rigs. You know, they call them shutdowns, or where they shut down an oil rig, or they start building one, you know.
So he's working for one of them big companies that just does oil rigs.
Brown and Root, Exxon, all those different companies, yeah.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
As a foreman at that time?
No, but back in those days, just a pipe fitter.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a filthy hard job.
It is a filthy hard job, man. My dad put in work. I remember there'd be times, you know, I grew up in like, one of the blessings, and you're going to laugh me saying, is one of the blessings I had is living in a fucking trailer park. I grew up in trailer parks. In Texas, we lived in the projects and we lived in trailer parks. I got to see all different kinds of culture, especially being West Indian.
Yeah.
So you got the Trinidadian experience, which is multicultural. 5 most spoken languages in Trinidad. Ready?
Yeah.
English, Bengali, French, Spanish, and Chinese.
How many you speak?
I speak one, which is, and I barely speak English.
Yeah.
You know, and I studied French for a long time, but I'm not fluent in French at all. And I studied it for a long time.
You gotta have a knack for it.
You really do. I lived in Paris, and I went to school at the European Language Foundation while I was there. Teachers refused to speak to me in English, and I managed to get around. But once you're not there, once you're not running it all the time, you don't.
Yeah. All right, so you go to Texas.
So I go to Texas. And
so you're living in the trailer park.
Living in the trailer parks, you know, just kind of exposed me to culture in ways that I hadn't thought about.
Like what kind of culture? Good? Are you talking good or bad?
Well, like, it was a different kind of racism. It was a different kind of...
Trailer park racism?
Yeah, it was different. And I realized, like, you know, it wasn't just us. Like, I always felt like, oh, you know, black people have it so bad. And here I am, 13 years old, living in a trailer park. And I'm like, oh.
White people, they don't got it so good either.
Oh, shit. So it's poor people. It's everybody. Yeah. I was like, oh, wow. And, you know, that was interesting. And
was there any bonding, though? Was there any sort of, like... That's an interesting idea. I'd obviously thought that, you know, the idea of poor white people, poor black people, that there is oppression and a sort of contempt of the poor, and a lot of race. That's something we don't talk about in America, is class.
Right.
But was there any sort of unity around, you know, the anger of treatment of whites and blacks together?
You know what? We weren't intelligent enough. I don't think at the time, I don't think that people were. I think that. Well, what I picked up on was that in the being West Indian, right? And or even just being a black American, being someone who was born, I'm the first American born in my family. Like, what I had noticed amongst my people is that there was classism, there was racism according to complexion. So I was darker complected, so I couldn't get into a light skinned party.
Really?
You know, oh my God, it's hilarious. This is I wish I was making this stuff up.
A light skinned party.
Yes.
How is that advertised? What's that invitation look like? Do they give you the tone?
Like, if there's a party, well, you know what, like, if you like literally, like, oh, I hate to say this, but you just weren't invited, you know?
too black.
Yeah, or you couldn't get in because, you know, it's funny. It's just, I just realized that there was this oppression, this learned oppression that we had imposed upon ourselves.
Right.
And not just in America, in the Caribbean, you know, in right. my black experience, that's what I experienced, you yeah. know? And then when I was in these trailer parks, I was like, oh shit, they do the same thing to each other. You know what I mean?
The white people.
They're yeah. classist, you know, they're classist with, you know, within themselves. And I'm yeah. like, but we all live in, oh, so you have a double wide trailer park. Yeah. So, oh, you have a double wide trailer. yeah. Oh, I see. So, all right, you know.
Yeah, right. So it happens there too.
Exactly.
And the house on the hill is a double wide down the street.
yeah, you know what I'm saying? Literally, yeah. that's perfect one. That's perfect. I got to, can I use that from sure. now on to explain this?
yeah.
And yeah, so I, you know, that was eye opening for me, but I don't think that we were, I don't think that everyone saw it that way. And to communicate and identify with that, but we bonded over different things. We bonded over football and
yeah.
you know, and baseball and music, you know.
So what were your ambitions at this point? When did you start to decide that you were going to express yourself artistically?
I was about 7 or 8, and a dude that lived a few blocks away from me. I lived yeah. on 224th and Merrick Boulevard, and a kid that lived there named Timmy got shot at the park. And we were all kind of mourning Timmy's passing. We were all sad. We're at my friend Eddie's house, and there was a guy named Mark who was a little older than all of us. And Mark said a rap. And he said, I heard a shot. I heard a cry. I said, Timmy, 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 did you have to die? You have to understand, as a 6 or 7 year old, hearing that, I was like, oh, wait a minute. We can express ourselves like that? From that point forward, I was like, I'm gonna be a rapper, period. And then shortly thereafter, my dad came home with this record called Rapper's Delight, yeah. Sugar Hill Gang.
Yeah.
And that was all she wrote.
So you start doing some 8-year-old raps?
Started doing some 8-year-old raps. I write raps for me and my brother. They were corny, like, you know, yeah. well, I'm kid nice and I'm sweeter than spice. And when I rap to the ladies, they melt like ice. Cause that was the style back then, yeah, you yeah. know? And that was the beginning of it. But I kind of kept, I was really, you know, I was kind of like, you know, we were kind of like the bummy kids mm-hmm. in New York. We were like the bummy kids but that didn't have much supervision.
Yeah.
So I kind of kept that quiet, you know what I mean?
Right.
And maintained my reputation as being scrappy.
Yeah.
Which I was.
And, as opposed to someone who writes things?
Well, you know, just opposed to someone who was extremely vocal.
Uh-huh.
You know, and outgoing.
So scrappy means, like, you know, those are those kids that they don't talk much, they don't have much supervision.
It's just ugly kids that didn't have much to lose. You know what I'm saying? I get into a fight with anybody because I didn't have much to lose.
You were a fighter?
I was.
Yeah?
When I was really young, that was the way of expression.
Really?
Yeah.
So you kicked some ass?
I kicked some ass and I got my ass kicked. And my dad was the type of dude that'd be like, did you kick him in the face? Did you kick him in the face? Okay, well, he don't respect you. The next time you see him, you kick him in the face.
Just out of nowhere.
Right. You know, my dad was like very angry and unresolved, and, you know, and so his anger would manifest in violence, you know?
Yeah. So so you're in Texas. How long do you stay there?
I graduated. I graduated from high school and junior high in Texas and joined the military.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's a hell of a story.
Oh, man.
What military?
Marine Corps.
You joined the Marines?
Joined the Marines, yeah.
You went through all that? Is that why you're in good shape and you seem focused?
You know what? I have to say that the Marines definitely, they gave me some focus. And it definitely, you know what the Marines teach you?
What?
How to play the game without emotion.
Uh-huh.
And because I'm a very emotional person, I have convictions, I get very emotionally invested in things.
Yeah.
Look, the Marines helped me. I got to make that really clear. Like, I told them I had a chance at a record deal in California, and I was a reserve. They stationed me in California so that I could pursue my dream. So not knocking it, but just the military as a whole, when it really boils down to it, right?
Yeah.
You know, we follow the orders of, like, the elite 0.1%.
Sure.
And when we're in these...
The real house on the hill.
yeah. And when we're in these places, you know, nobody looks at the... I don't think anybody thinks of the White House as being real anymore.
No.
But, you know, when you look at... When you put, you know, 19-year-olds in these situations where they're tricked into believing they're doing something noble when in all actuality, they're clearing the fields so that that elite 0.1% can set up their oil rigs and extract natural resources.
So your dad was working...
Yeah.
for the same people that you were dying for.
Exactly. Absolutely. That was the system. That was the system. That is the system. It's not was.
So when you, so you were able to join as a reservist?
Well, yeah, I joined. I had to do boot camp. I had to do School of Infantry. So, you know, I went and did the boot camp. Really, it's a trip. You know, a dude is telling you, you know, pick up your Foot Locker, which is it, all your belongings are in it. Run it all the way to the end of the barracks, drop it, run to the other end of the barrack, touch the wall, run back and pick up your Foot Locker and run it back to the other end and repeat that 100 times. After a while, you just detach. I never forget. I first got to the military, right?
For what? Just for what? Just because they want to?
Well, you were in
they
trouble.
Decide you were scrappy?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, they do it to everybody. Like when we first got off the buses and we first showed up at boot camp, they had like 300 of us in a room. And all the drill sergeants are sitting up on the table in front of us.
Yeah.
And they're joking with us. Hey, you know, who eats pussy?
Yeah.
Who does this? Who does that?
Yeah.
And kids are raising their hand because the drill sergeants are joking with them.
Yeah.
And this one guy, I forgot his name, he raised his hand and goes, you eat pussy, huh, Private? What's your name, Private? Said Private so-and-so. Yeah. I said, okay, all right. You eat pussy. You eat that pussy till the booty and the head cave in? Sir, yes, sir, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And the kid starts joking with them. And they flipped on a dime, surrounded him, and I thought they were going to beat his ass. And they were like, you think it's Private? You're making eye contact with me, Private? They were going in on him so hard. I was like, oh, I get the game. I get the game.
They were seeing who's the smartest.
Yeah, they set you up, you know what I mean?
Yeah, to see who...
For an opportunity to... Exactly.
Who's got some moxie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what I did was, from that point forward, I clicked.
Yeah.
I followed orders and did what I was supposed to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And just knew that it was temporary.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was always in first, second, or third.
But you chose this.
I chose it completely. But I just didn't know how it went until
Why'd
I got
you choose
there.
It?
Because I didn't really, all I knew was that I wanted to be a rapper. And I didn't really have any other direction than that. So I thought that if I got my military time down, at least I would have the option for the GI Bill.
Yeah.
So I said, you know what? I'll have the GI Bill in place. I can always go in and use it towards getting a house, use it towards getting, you know, an education.
Right.
I didn't know that, you know, from the time that you sign up for the GI Bill, you actually extend your term. At the time, that's what the deal was.
So you were in for how long?
4 years.
So that's it?
That was it.
And you ended up, what, you went to boot camp, you went to...
I only did like three...
What, infantry training?
Yeah. I was... Yeah, that's the thing. You can choose any MOS you want, but I ended up being a grunt, 0311. And so I did boot camp, and then with the School of Infantry, we call it School of Infantry back in the day,
right?
And that was on Camp Pendleton, and you know, we just basically learned the drills. We learned hand to hand combat. We learned how to shoot.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Damn, back in them days, I was running 3 miles through the woods, through the mountains, in like 17.
Well, you're still in good shape, right?
I'm decent. You know what I mean? I'm decent, but yeah, I try to. It's just really more eating than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Just I avoid sugar at all costs. So back to answer your first question of when did I start to use my voice was that when I moved to Texas, you know, living in trailer parks and whatnot, I decided to be vocal about my rapping then. And I went from kind of like being like this bummy nerdy kid in Texas to kind of being like one of the Ranger rappers, because our school mascot was a Ranger.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I became the Ranger rapper one of the Ranger rappers at my school.
So doing it in front of the crowds at the sporting events?
Over the intercom, in front of the crowds.
You were the guy?
Me and a couple. I had a whole crew, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then that kind of gave me a voice that I never had before. Hip-hop gave me a voice, and I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
I can say anything I want.
You could write jokes. You could be funny. You could push buttons.
I could push buttons all day, and that's what I live for.
Pushing buttons.
That's right. Say it with a straight
face.
Not
in the Marines.
Non-Marines, they were trying to push your buttons.
Yeah.
They literally, if you saw a drill sergeant stand in front of, if in front of a puddle, don't flinch.
Because
the minute they're gonna seek out the weak one, they're gonna be like, okay, you know, Private Marin, come here, come here, boy, you are fucking me, Private. So no, now you have to stand in front of him. That means you're standing in the puddle.
Right.
Drop, Private. Roll, Private. Roll right, Private. Roll left, Private. Get up, Private. Get out of my goddamn sight, Private.
All full of mud.
Yes, right.
Just because what?
Just because. And that's how you learn to detach. That's how you learn to detach.
So you learn to detach by saying, I don't want to be that guy.
Well, I learned to detach in the sense that I roll through the mud, crawl through it, you know, sleep on top of a king snake or whatever I had to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In order to get the job done and
so
not make it personal.
Did you go anywhere? Did you fight?
No. I got lucky. You know, we had this invasion where Saddam's invasion of Kuwait.
Yeah,
they started pulling our troops,
mm-hmm.
and we were like number 23.
Yeah,
dudes in our battalion started fleeing to like Canada and shit.
It was really funny. The reservists started bolting?
Yeah, started bolting, started getting girls pregnant. They were like, yeah, if you have a baby, you don't have to go. I was like, what?
What? Yeah, that doesn't seem right.
It didn't seem right at all. And anyway, Kuwait's surrender was so quick.
You didn't go?
Didn't have to go.
And that was what? How many years in were you already?
2 years.
And you were living in L.A.?
I was living in Houston. I was stationed back in Houston. And then I said I wanted a rap career. And in 89... I packed up and moved to California.
And you were still in?
Still in.
Third year.
It's third year. And it would literally, there's a base right over there, not too far from here.
Yeah.
There's an Air Force base over there by Stadium Way that the Marines share with the Air Force. And I would go over there and do like paperwork and stuff for them straight up.
And that was your only requirement?
That's my only requirement.
Yeah, show up for work occasionally.
That's it.
So you come out, so what were you doing in Houston?
I went to school, junior high and high school in Baytown, Texas. So my goal was to go get my crew and move to California so that we could get a record deal. But they didn't want to go. They were like, we can do it right here in Houston.
Yeah. You
know? And it's true, there were like some budding rap groups like the Ghetto Boys, Royal Flush, Raheem. There was a record label called Rap-A-Lot Records. There was a dope dude named Action back in the day.
And you knew all these Scarface guys?
I mean, we would rap with them at the or battle rap and stuff like that at this club called the Rhinestone Wrangler back in the
Houston?
Day. In Houston? In
Houston. And that, what was that like, battle rapping? This is a world I don't know about. So you got...
Battle, you know, it's like you go for the jugular. You try to hurt people's feelings.
The other guy.
You try to hurt the other. You try to destroy their crew.
So it's not a collaborative community thing. It's more like the dozens amplified.
It's the dozens amplified, but then you come together and you're like, you know, it's the game. It's the game.
Right.
I never forget this guy named Willie D. He said he had this thing where we used to wear these kung fu shoes all the time.
Your guys.
Yeah. And he had this joke. This dude said, it should crack me up so much. He said, oh, this motherfucker dressed like he know karate. Head like a donkey and a German Shepherd body. The country is funniest shit I ever heard. This shit had me crying.
So when you do that, it's all improvised usually?
A lot of time we just made it off from the top of our heads. But we would come with prepared raps too.
Yeah.
So you get to go in on them, like make some personal shit about them.
So this was a whole night. So guys would be on stage together?
Yeah. And we were too young to be in the club. So Big Steve, who owned the Rhinestone, would make us sit by the door until it was time to battle.
Yeah.
And then we got to go on stage and battle with the big dudes, you know.
We
were just so good.
Yeah.
He was like, I get these dudes.
And your kids too, which is cool.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
they're exactly. Like, these youngsters are going to come in here and do this thing.
Exactly.
And you're waiting by the stage door?
Waiting by the stage door. But we opened our mouths on stage.
Yeah.
It was a problem.
Yeah.
It was a problem. Like I'll never forget, I ain't going to say the rap group's name, wanting to beat our asses in the parking lot. And people were like, yo, man, they kids. He's like, yeah, but they talk like grown-ups, nigga. You going to say some shit. I never forget that shit.
They talk like grown-ups.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't give a shit.
He wanted to whoop our asses.
But generally it was friendly.
It was friendly. You know, man, and we had a community, like it was a hip hop community. Ultimately we did things for that community.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it was new in the sense that, you know, the South was kind of disregarded back in those days, in hip hop. You know, the West Coast had their thing and the East Coast refused to acknowledge us. And at the time they were kind of the conduit, you know. So you know, In its rebellion, the South started forming its own thing. Little Jay, who was who owned Rap-A-Lot Records, you know, started this label. He started signing people like Action, who became Scarface, who became one of my favorite rappers of all time.
Uh-huh.
The Ghetto Boys and all that, and they started getting this surge, you know. And now you got, you know.
I remember I had the Ghetto Boy, one of the Ghetto Boy albums, maybe the first album, just because that guy was so fascinating.
Which one?
The little guy.
Oh, Bushwick Bill. Yeah. You had the one. You had
where
the
he's
one.
All fucked up on the cover.
A Mind Playing Tricks on Me album.
Yeah.
I don't know which album was.
Yeah.
The Action, the Scarface album that got me was that Gunshots Rang Out. What the fuck? Heard this nigga bite the bullet. Like, damn, fucked him up. It was basically the soundtrack of Office Space.
Right.
Remember, it starts out, he's in the car when he's saying that rap. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's right. He's singing it, and then they pull up next to him.
That album is one of my favorites, you know. That might have been the Ghetto Boys Resurrection album, actually, because they broke up. They had a guy named Big Mike join and take Scarface's place. And then Scarface eventually came back. When Scarface is in the group, he produces great music and he just says crazy shit.
Yeah. And wait, so that was your dream, man.
That was my dream. I lived my dream.
And you, but you, what? So you're doing it in Houston with your guys,
right? So I eventually got him to agree to move to California. So we finally got to California in '89,
yeah,
June of '89, and we got our record deal about a year later.
What was the name of the?
Our group was called the College Boys.
Uh huh.
And we signed to Virgin Records.
Yeah.
We were one hit wonders. We had a hit called "Victim of the Ghetto," which happened to be happening at this exact same time as the riots, the Los Angeles riots.
Right.
So the Los Angeles riots kind of helped amplify, you know, right, because every news station that spoke about this riot nationwide,
yeah,
also played our music in the background.
Really?
Yeah.
So you got a hit off of Rodney King's demise.
A hit off of Rodney King's rise and demise.
Right.
Yeah, you know, because Rodney King was big in the clubs for a minute.
Yeah.
After that, he'd show up in the club like he was, you know, like he was the man.
Yeah, he was, and, but he was a little beat up.
Yeah.
I mean, he was obviously beat up in the horrible situation.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
He was sort
right.
of I don't know if he was, you know, sadly, the position that he had culturally was a lot, you know. It was a heavy burden in a way.
Right, you know, you're right. It's funny because I was so young and insensitive at the time,
yeah,
that I was really angered by the situation because we had all experienced our things with cops. And, you know, Rodney King was like, I think his famous quote,
all get along.
Yeah. And in my mind, I was actually thinking, like,
no.
I was angry. I was angry, I'll just say that. And so, in retrospect,
yeah,
you know, he's aware of what he's done in his life,
mm-hmm,
and he's aware of what his karma is. Mm-hmm. And if that was the perspective that he had at the time, the mature thing to do was to honor it.
Right.
You know.
Right. To be a spokesman.
Exactly.
Of peace.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. To you know, it had two purposes.
Yeah. Exactly. It would have been great. It would have been great. That's fucked up.
It would have been great if he said, "Fuck all you all."
No. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, but this is bullshit. But
it'd been even great if he had something profound to say. It would have been great.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. But I mean, what, you know, what is there to say at that moment? You know what I mean?
I mean, you know, that there's a, I mean, at least for me at the time, was that there was a major imbalance in the, you know, in the profiling.
Yeah.
You know, and that there's this this convenient way of making young Black Americans a scapegoat for the judicial system and for,
right,
the prison system, you know. And at the time, that was really obvious to me, you know.
Yeah.
And speak about the amount of tax dollars that go into it. And if you're someone who isn't, you know, look, if, from my research,
yeah,
your birth certificate is basically a banknote that's handed over to the Federal Reserve anyway, right?
Right.
So ultimately, each person on average is worth about, and my numbers could be off, but about $750,000 in taxes over a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, all the debt that 0.1% accrues, they pay them back by handing over these banknotes to the Federal Reserve,
mm-hmm,
right? And if you become a non-taxpaying citizen, as far as America's concerned, well, we're going to get the taxes out of you by putting you in jail.
And
when you're in jail, we'll get $166 $166 a day in tax money from the public to pay for your incarceration.
I never heard it framed that way.
Leave it up to me to do some shit like that. You know what I mean?
I like it. You got a desire to break it down to its most simple,
yes,
definition.
You have to.
Your birth certificate's a banknote. If you ain't paying on that note, they're going to put you in jail to make their money.
Yeah. Bottom line. I mean, that's how it looks to me. And you know what? That's my interpretation of the information that I've collected. I'm not saying it's a fact.
That sounds like a good rap. Yeah, that would be like, yeah.
Think about that, damn it.
The idea that your birth certificate's a banknote for the Federal Reserve?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's fucking some cutting through the hypocrisy. That is some solid verse there.
You know, see, that's what rap does. So even if you're wrong, mm-hmm, rap, as I grew up in it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because if you say it with enough confidence,
exactly,
people be like, it makes sense.
Well, you create dialogue around the subject, and
that's,
you get,
right,
to the bottom of it.
Right.
You know what I mean? To a degree, history as we know it and what's really going on in actual politics as we know it in foreign affairs is all a mystery because the corporations are writing it, you know, conveniently.
Right.
So, you know, it's great, in my opinion, to speculate and to, like, inspire people to, like, research. And
well, yeah, I've said that the American democracy is a money laundering front.
That's how you break it down to its most basic form.
Right.
Thank you. That's what, I mean, it's hilarious. Like, when I see people, I honestly, like, you ever date a girl, or has maybe a girl's ever dated you, and you realize within 5 minutes of being in this person's presence that, oh man, this person has a lot of unresolved pain, is completely out of touch with their own pain, and right, and you're like, and you get a sympathy in your heart for that person.
Yeah, after you feel the sympathy comes right after you feel attacked.
Yes, yes. Well, that's
that hurt. That
exactly.
Is that my fault?
Exactly.
I don't think it is. Oh, this chick's fucked up. Now what do I do?
Okay, exactly. And like, that's how I feel when I hear people having like really heated debates over Democrats and Republicans going at it. There's a part of my heart that sincerely hurts for them because, you know, I
mean, does that part win over the fuck that?
No, I don't. I don't participate in that. I mean, look, because we get to vote on whether or not gay marriage is legal. We get to vote on things like, you know, these social issues. But as far as foreign affairs,
right?
Do you think they're going to let the average layman, foreign affairs? Now, this is a huge conglomerate.
No, I mean, they're going back to Iraq.
Exactly. No,
they didn't ask me.
Dude, do you think, exactly, you think they're going to let us vote? Us, the layman who doesn't even know what the petrodollar is. They're going to let us choose the CEO for that conglomerate for the next eight years?
No, but see, but that's the whole problem now, is that, you know, that there's such an aggravated apathy once the reality has been shown to the people that do vote and even the people that don't vote, that they're not working in our interest, that all they're banking on is enough people are going to, when they go like, how you doing? They're going to go like, nah, I don't know, I'm okay. All right. Well, if most of the people say that, and there's a couple of others on the fringe saying like, this is fucked up.
Yeah.
Or the other guy saying like, I ain't making enough money.
Yeah.
As long as those are relative minorities to the people that are disconnected and going like, nah, I'm all right. I can eat. And I don't give a shit about the rest of it. That's who it's driven by.
Yeah.
It's not driven by right or wrong. It's driven by like, who do I vote for? That guy seems like, I like his hair. No. So they don't give a fuck.
No.
But they don't represent anything but business interests.
I completely, don't be wrong. You know, the last girl I dated, her dad was a delegate, and you know, it really helped me. I got to go in and see them vote on something. And I realized that when you go state to state, people care.
In the state government. Thank God there are people that are showing up at the meetings.
Exactly.
They're taking action. Like all the people that really give a shit, that's what they do. They don't look for attention.
Yeah.
They're not arguing with, you know, people on television, grassroots, you know, organizations, and also community-based politics. Yeah. People that really give a shit, those are the unsung heroes of what really makes democracy great.
I always say when I make my movies and I'm the star of my movies and I get to allocate tickets, those are the people, those teachers that the students vote for, and those people, those delegates, those people working on the ground, you know, on the ground level, are the people that I'm bringing to my premiere, and I'm showcasing it every opportunity that I get, whatever opportunity it is, as shallow as it may sound,
right,
whatever way I can reward them, whatever way I can enhance and make their lives better or help them get acknowledged for what they're doing, that's my goal. And back to what you the point that you were making is that, you know, if you look at activists that are being effective, they don't even fuck with the White House.
No.
The White House is a waste of fucking time. They go straight to the corporations. They hit you in the pocket. They know who the bosses are. That's how you get shit done. And look, let's just, I don't know if you know this, but like African Americans are slated to spend like $1.1 trillion by 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're spending money. They respond to advertising and they're
huge, go to shows.
They go to shows.
They go to movies.
Yep, they're huge consumers.
Your movie did 30 million the first weekend.
Thank you. During the World Cup, mind you. During the friggin' World Cup. So, you know, my point being is that if people just acknowledged their purchasing power.
Yeah.
And they were like, you know what? If we could collectively boycott, but that's why all these, this division is so put in place, is that it's to prevent that. It's to prevent that type of unification, saying,
sure,
okay,
fight amongst yourselves.
Exactly.
Divide and conquer.
Right, because if we were to do that, what we would then do is we could demand of these corporations, yo, we got your iPads and shit. Why don't you come put some money in this school? In fact, we won't be buying your shit until you do.
Yeah.
And if we were able to do that, I understand enough to know that division, you know, is important for, in order for like the higher ups to sustain, you have to divide.
Keep them fighting over bullshit.
Exactly. So, but if we were to do that, that's really, you want to change. That's all how you do it. You hit him in the pocket.
Well, right. Well, okay. So so now we're talking, you know, Romney Malco, the activist.
I'm not an activist.
No, but I'm saying that, you know, like you think about this stuff. Mm-hmm. So you're rapping. So you had a voice.
Yeah, I had a voice.
And you had the one hit. Mm-hmm. And then how does it go from there to acting and to making that decision then?
Well, after I had my rap career, I started doing jingles with my boy Nitro.
Uh-huh.
And I was having such a blast doing jingles. I thought I'd never really go back to doing anything in hip hop.
Jingles
again.
For what?
Like Shore commercials, Honeycomb commercials. Dude, I became like, I'm not kidding you. We'd have like 4 jingles on the air at once.
And that's a good paycheck.
Incredible. We had a blast.
Yeah.
And you know, rap was popular for these jingles back in the day.
Yeah.
So sometimes we'd make singing hooks, but sometimes singing jingles, sometimes we'd make like rap jingles, you know. And we would have a blast. Me and Nitro, Night Diggy, giving a shout out to Darren Clowers right now. What up, man?
The Jingle Guys.
And so after that, I'm going to produce records. So I produced like CeCe Peniston and stuff like that. Not her big hit, but uh-huh. I did get to produce some stuff on CeCe Peniston. And I did some stuff with Randy Crawford. And then after that, I started an internet business. And I'm telling you right now.
Yeah.
We are not going into this. I'm just going to say this. I started an internet business,
yeah.
And that shit changed my life. 1997, I decide I'm selling stuff on the internet. I start selling shit on the internet, and within 3 months, it's not a whole lot of money, but at the time it was.
Yeah.
I was making more money in 3 months than I'd ever made as a rapper.
Selling what?
Health products that revolved around male health. Specifically,
okay.
So if you wanted
boner pills,
if you wanted to get increase your fertility,
herbal
if you
stuff.
Wanted like natural, like
okay.
herbal stuff for like you wanted to gain muscle.
Were you manufacturing this stuff?
Or? I was not, but I was getting private label deals.
Uh huh.
Uh-huh. I was getting private label deals.
Okay.
And
so were you using your image, your picture, like, look at me?
Hell no. I pretended to be somebody else. Because I was like, if they find out that a rapper is selling them this shit, it's going. If they find out that a black dude is behind this company, we in trouble. You
right.
know what I mean? So I did it. I would pretend to be, I would speak to everybody on the phone and just pretend to be a spokesperson for the company, but I would never make it seem like I owned it or that it was me.
But it was your thing.
It was my thing.
And where the hell did that come from? Where'd the incentive for that, the inspiration? You're producing records, you're rapping, you're making jingles, I'm going to sell herbal boner pills.
A comedian that you know, who I'm not going to name,
okay.
said she was going to be in a certain magazine.
Okay.
It turns out that when I went through the magazine, it was just her hands,
uh-huh.
and she was holding a blurb in Details magazine.
Uh-huh.
I read that blurb and it gave me the impression, it like a light bulb. I was like, if I advertised on sports radio,
mm-hmm.
I'd be hitting 99% of my demographic if I started, you know, doing things around male health. And I couldn't let that go. After that, it was all about.
You just had an idea. It was an entrepreneurial idea.
Absolutely.
Had nothing to do with your creativity necessarily. It was just sort of like, I got to do this.
Yes, because I've always been an aspiring. In junior high, I sold candy. In junior high, I sold buttons. I'd make Menudo buttons and New Edition buttons and sell those.
So you're always like a little little entrepreneur guy.
Always. I used to throw parties. By the time I got to high school, I was throwing the biggest parties in Baytown. Me and my boys were throwing huge parties.
For money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So you had that going. You knew you wanted to make bank big.
I knew I wanted to make bank at some point.
And, somehow. Didn't matter.
Did not really, to be quite frank.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to sell drugs.
Right.
We sold a little weed.
Right.
But I did not feel good about that. I did not feel good about
that. You can't set up a site for weed, not then.
No.
Maybe now.
Yeah, exactly. But
even
know,
that's dicey.
Yeah. I mean, you know what? It's funny, though. Like, you know.
How long did you keep that site going?
That site went until about my first really decent acting gig. I would say, though, I kept it to 97 to about 2004.
Wow.
2004.
And it kept doing well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was the funniest thing where I had an agent being like, you're going to have to choose. Because
you're making good money there.
Yeah, if this links back to this, you know, and I started stepping away from the business. I got calls from Howard Stern. I used to be on Jonathan Brandmeier's show all the time. It was ridiculous.
On the phone?
No, man, live on his radio station.
For the male herbal stuff?
Mm-hmm.
On the radio, though?
On the radio.
So they still can connect you, but you're using a real name.
What else you want to talk about?
All right, so when did the acting break come? How'd you get into that?
I get a call from George Stephanopoulos, right? You know, yeah. George Stephanopoulos. His brother, Andrew Stephanopoulos, and I are pretty decent friends, yeah. Right? And Andrew Stephanopoulos
How'd
is always-
How'd you meet that guy?
At Virgin Records, when I had gotten my record.
When did the Paris thing happen?
The Paris thing, that was when I shot a movie with Paul Rudd.
Before the website?
It was during the website.
Okay. Shot a movie. So you going out for auditions, you had an agent.
I didn't have an agent. I got into acting because John Leguizamo heard some stuff that I had done for Paula Abdul's animated cat.
Yeah.
And he was like, I want to rap like that for my movie called The Pest.
Yeah.
And I want to say that this was around the time that my business was doing decent. So it might be 98, 99.
Yeah.
And so I started writing this stuff for John Leguizamo and we started hanging out. And his wife at the time was named Yelba.
Yelba.
And she was like, Rom, we hang out with comedians. You one of the funniest people we ever met. And I wasn't trying to be funny.
Yeah.
So it was an insult. I never thought of myself as funny.
Right.
But John was like, you mind auditioning for this movie? And I was like, fuck it, I'll give it a shot. So he couldn't be there because he was off filming Romeo and Juliet. So I would audition for the casting agent, Wendy Kurtzman, and the director. They called me back 6 times. They called me back for a mixed match session. Yeah. I didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
The brother from Mad TV, who was also in Jerry Maguire. Ari Spears, my bad. So I didn't get the role. Didn't trip, went about my business, back to my internet business. I was traveling to Japan, Italy. My business afforded me luxuries I didn't have before. I had a beautiful girlfriend. We were doing everything we could, right? Yeah. And she was really smart. She's like, oh, let's go to the Galapagos.
Yeah.
Okay, you know?
Yeah.
And then about a year goes by and I'm getting calls from all over the place. And I'm paranoid now, like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
And it turns out that it was just basically a bunch of, you know, my girl was like calling me and saying, we're getting faxes from these people. They tracked you down through the music industry. And I'm like,
about what?
I'm like, why the fuck are you telling people my shit? Why are you giving them my fax number? You don't know who this is. I'm thinking it could be the cops or some shit, yeah. Right? And it was basically casting agents in Hollywood. Casting agents in Hollywood. Wendy Kurtzman had told them that I was her favorite audition of all time. And it was pilot season. So the word had gotten out and they'd all wanted me to come in and audition for stuff. So I went in and ended up testing for a couple of things and they were like, and then agents started saying they wanted to represent me. And so I just listened to all the messages. I had like, I don't know, 30 messages from all these people. And there was this one lady named Lisa DeSante who sounded really nice and sincere.
Yeah.
And she's the only person that I called back. I went and sat with her, had a checkbook in my pocket. At the end of it, I was like, how much is it going to be? And she's like, no, baby. I get you checks.
Yeah.
And I was like,
who do I write this to?
You looking at this Italian chick, she looking at me. I'm talking about how much. We sat in the office for like 3 hours.
Yeah.
And she was like, No.
Yeah.
I pay you. I'm going to get you paid. And then that was it. And I started acting from there.
Did you stay with her?
I stayed with her forever. But there came a point where, you know, Lisa DeSante has a huge temper.
Mm-hmm.
And her temper was...
Is she a solo shop? Or she work for somebody?
She she's a manager now. She's all established and rocking now. Right. But at the time, I went, you know, I tried to stay with her best as I could. But to justify my move from Lisa DeSante, I would just say that I had a manager and I had Lisa DeSante as my agent. Lisa DeSante was sending me out for the role to play Tupac in this MC Hammer story.
Yeah.
And my management called her and said, don't do that. And she was like, why not? She's like, because he should be the lead. And they had an argument.
Yeah.
And I ended up booking the lead.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, I didn't even think of myself as the lead.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to be in the company of people who think of me as the lead. You know what I mean?
Right. What was that movie called?
So, it was called Too Legit, the MC Hammer Story. It was a VH1 movie.
Oh, okay. So, all right. So you did a lot of little stuff. Did a lot of bit parts. There were funny bit parts, right?
Yeah. I mean, some were funny and some were straight. One of them was a drama, my first show was called Level 9. And after I booked enough TV, I booked a lot of commercials first. And then after I booked commercials, I started booking a lot of TV. And then after I started booking a lot of TV, I worked my way up to getting a TV show. And then after a TV show, I started working my way up to getting small roles in movies and then eventually worked up to being a significant player in a movie. But what happened is around 2000, one of my best friends, his name is Jesse Peretz, who I had met through my girlfriend. My girlfriend's bigger sister booked me in my first commercial at the time. I met a guy named Jesse Peretz. And Jesse Parrott and I became best friends over the weirdest thing. I made this thing called mango chow, which is a common dish you eat in the Caribbean. He ate it. He was the director on a commercial. He ate it and goes, I was doing craft service with my buddy Josh, who was the ex-boyfriend of my current girlfriend.
You were working craft service?
Craft service with my boy Josh.
Yeah.
And he was like, this is before I started my company.
Right.
And I met Jesse.
Yeah.
And Jesse tasted my mango chow and was like, I used to eat this. My Trinidadian babysitter used to make this. This is a Jewish guy telling me this. Yeah, yeah. And then he starts imitating the Trinidadian accent. We were best friends from that point forward.
Still?
Still. Mm-hmm. And he ended up, you know, he ended up directing this movie and he wanted to cast people for the movie. So he had this guy named Ross Broccoli who was really funny.
I know Ross Broccoli.
Ross Broccoli's fucking funny as
He's
shit.
He's in Nebraska. Ross was a guy, one of my guys back in the day.
Yeah, I gave Ross a place to stay one time, and this motherfucker wakes up in the middle of the night and goes through my closet.
Yeah? Was he in his sleep?
He was sleeping. Opens the front.
When was this? When were you hanging out with Ross Broccoli?
Ross Broccoli 2000? Oh, 1999, 2000.
Is it right? That was back when I knew him, yeah.
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
He had a little falling out, but I mean, he ended up going, he did some commercials, he stashed the money, he went and he bought a farm. He lives in Nebraska.
Good for Ross. Good for Ross.
He was an interesting guy.
He really, really was. See, yeah. He's the kind of guy that you would find me hanging out with.
Yeah.
Unintentionally. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and what's the director's name? Parrots?
Jesse Parrots. He's pretty much the producer. He's a producer on Girls. Does a lot of Nurse Jackie.
I think I just met this guy because I just did a part in Girls.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple weeks ago.
You met him.
He's your best friend?
Yeah, man. That's my brother.
Jesse. God damn. Small world.
Jesse Parrott is my brother.
Yeah, he introduced himself to me. Okay. It's all making sense. Ross Broccoli, you.
Yeah.
Everybody's connected.
Yep, exactly. So, you know.
What movie did he put you in?
A movie called The Chateau.
Okay.
I begged him not to put me in it. So we said, okay, well, then just help me cast it. Because I wasn't really an actor at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I helped them cast it. And after I helped him cast it, he asked me to play a small role. And so he put me on camera for it, carried it back to his producers. And the producers were like, why can't Romney be Paul Rudd's brother? And I was like, Jesse, your first move, First Love, Last Rites, was not a success.
Yeah.
If you want to fail again, put me in your movie. Do not do this to your career. I beg you.
Yeah.
And they insisted, and we ended up doing that movie, and it pretty much changed our careers.
Oh, was it a good movie?
It was a great movie. I mean, it was like a really independent movie, and it was, aesthetically, it was horrible, because we shot.
This was the Paris thing.
It was the thing in Paris.
Yeah. And you and Paul still friends?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And we shot that for like 13 days.
Yeah.
We shot it for 13 days, and I just never left. I was like, I'm staying. Peace.
How long did you stay?
About 6 months.
Uh-huh.
I had to come home.
Yeah.
You know, but I just didn't want to leave.
So you made, so by that point, you're shifting out of the boner pills.
Yep. No. I'm going strong. I'm going strong on boner pills at this point. Boner pills is what's funding me in Paris.
Did they work?
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Oh, dude. Well, you know, it's so funny. Like, I've been so blessed because growing up in West Indian culture,
yeah.
If you had a problem, there was a natural remedy for this thing.
Yeah.
And so this whole pharmaceutical culture was pretty foreign in my family.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's like even to this day, if people tell me they have a problem with whatever, there's a natural solution to it, you know? Uh-huh. And, you know, so... Even to this day, it was such everything that my dad cooked when I was a kid. Drink this. This is good. This is good for the tool.
Yeah, for the tool.
Eat this. This is good for the tool. Everything was good for the damn tool. So of course I started a fucking business that was good for the tool.
What anyway. Were the herbs? Just asking for a friend.
Now you know there's things like guarana and. I can dig that stuff up, and I can promise you, I can point your guys in the right direction.
For the tool.
For the tool.
Help for the tool.
Everything good for the tool, man. Take that. That good for the tool. All that good for the tool. I still ain't answered your damn question. The point is that I did this movie with Jesse Parrott, and the next thing you know, people were asking me to be in other movies.
And but the big break that everyone knows you for, and which I you first sort of hit me, was as Jay in 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Yeah, Judd Apatow. He asked me to be in his movie because he saw me in The Chateau.
Yeah. And that was a funny part.
Yeah, I got
it. And that sort of defined you comedically.
It did. I was like, you know, I was new to the business. I didn't have a click. I didn't grow up and I didn't start acting until I was 30.
Yeah.
So I was new to the whole game. I didn't have a click. And to be pulled in by Judd Apatow and like introduced to all these guys and just do yourself.
Yeah.
What would you say?
Yeah.
I was like, seriously?
Like, wait, that's what you were doing?
I feel like the most common question in my life is,
yeah,
wait a minute, I can say what I want? Yeah. In everything. I can be in an interview. It can be, I can be dating someone. Wait, I can just say what I want. I could be rapping. I can say what I want.
Yeah.
Judd, you know, Judd was like really funny. He had great jokes. And like I never forget it. We were doing the first, with one of the earlier scenes where we're discovering that he's a virgin.
Yeah.
And I was saying, that's, you know, it's cool if you're gay.
Yeah.
You know, I got friends that's gay. And Judd yells, in jail.
Yeah.
I lost my shit. I must have chipped my tooth on that damn table. I lost my shit. Just to be around a guy who was so creative and fresh.
Yeah.
You know, 4 days into our production, the production got shut down by the studio because they thought, you know what? You've already shot in half the movie and we haven't approved the look. Mm-hmm. But just the Judd was covering so much footage because we were playing so much.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
And he was so seasoned by that time that he was like, no problem. Sent us all home, came back Monday and went back to work. Judd was great.
I guess that's the real skill of a great producer is just sort of like, keep your cool. Mm-hmm. And like, all right, we'll work this out.
Him and Shauna Roberts had no facial expression.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So like, okay, cool. All right, cool. All right, guys. So see you on Monday?
Yeah.
No, we'll let you know. We'll let you know. So you don't want me to come back tomorrow. We'll let you know.
So you do a few other roles, and then you do the Love Guru.
Yep. That was a... Look, if you look at every job that I've been involved in, 40-Year-Old Virgin, Baby Mama, Blades of Glory, Weeds.
Yeah.
I wanted to get next to the people that
How
I
was Weeds? That was great, right?
It was incredible. Mary Louise Parker is my sensei. She would kick my ass, and I thank her at the end of every day.
What do you mean she'd kick your ass?
She didn't fuck around, you know.
You were on that for what, a few seasons, right?
Yeah, it's Mary Louise Parker will punch you in the face.
She's a hell of an actress.
She was my sensei.
Deep.
And like, she really taught me. Well, first of all, my acting coach is who taught me.
Yeah.
Sandy Marshall flipped the script, broke me down. I used to laugh. I'd be in the pews laughing to people on stage crying, like these actor types.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Never considered myself one of them
until
I ended up crying on that stage.
She was your boot camp. That was your boot camp.
It was my
your
boot camp. Acting, and from that point forward, I knew.
She made you roll around in the puddle.
Exactly. She made it clear that everyone could see the through my facade.
The emotional puddle.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, man.
Time for you to meet you.
Exactly. That's what she did. I'm like, this shit is therapy.
Yeah.
I didn't sign up for no damn therapy.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, Sandy Marshall, she gave me free class. She just made me stay after class one day. She's like, I'm gonna tell you something. She goes, I think you're talented. And of all my students, I really believe that you could go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to give you free classes because I don't think that people give you things very often. And all you have to do is show up. That's what I did. I showed up.
You were a challenge. She was going to break you. She was going to make you what you are.
Yeah, and she really did. I never forget, man. I was like, you're right. I was rolling around in my own puddle, my own tears. I was like, ain't this some shit? It's just, you suddenly realize that everyone can see you.
Yeah.
They can see through your bullshit. They just tolerate you.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the good friends, they don't tell you. They just talk. They keep tolerating you. But a lot of people are like, I'm done with that.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't know that.
But they know the better part of you.
Right, exactly. But I was so charming and entertaining that it was really everyone else's entertainment at my expense. And I didn't realize that either.
Because you thought you were getting away with something.
Yes. Like, and she just completely exposed me, and I was like, ugh. And that from that point forward, I actually began to take it more seriously.
Like with something like The Love Guru, which was, you know, I mean, notorious tank.
Mm-hmm.
Does that affect your jobs?
You know what? For me, it didn't because in fact, it got me jobs.
Yeah.
But also, the shit that I learned from Mike Myers changed the game for me.
What was that?
Well, just everything. Like, he taught me things I did naturally. He suddenly made me aware of. Like,
right.
I didn't know what memes were.
Right.
And I didn't know that I was creating memes in my career. You know, in 40-Year-Old Virgin, I created all these memes.
Right.
I didn't know that shit. It's
hard to know until it becomes one. I mean, it's a rare person that does intentional memes.
Right, but it was years after the fact. And everywhere that I went with my mom, people were like, don't put the pussy on the pedestal. And, you know, I didn't know that those were memes.
Right.
I didn't understand that they were, I didn't know about color association.
Right.
So there's a color scheme and you can create certain color schemes that people will automatically associate with your movies, consciously or subconsciously. No fucking clue about that stuff. I had no idea. This dude, Mike Myers, is so fucking deep and smart.
Yeah.
Seriously speaking, like, it was another situation like being with Mary Louise Parker where right. you were, where if you didn't sit and take note, let them slap you in the face, you were an asshole.
Right.
Because there was so much to learn.
And you learned a lot about comedy, a lot about marketing.
Comedy.
But you'd already sort of done your own marketing thing. I mean, you had an instinct for it.
I did, but he showed me how to systemize it. Like, he had a trailer.
Yeah.
One trailer with just a wall full of pictures and colors and like a wall.
Yeah.
Not a wall, the entire trailer.
Yeah.
It's like, if you didn't know it was his, you'd be like, oh shit, somebody's getting murdered.
But it's weird because that movie didn't, you know, no. with all his memeing and colors.
Yeah, well, there were a couple of things that happened. One of the things that happened was that, you know, there was a great script in the beginning.
Yeah.
And because of the fact that, how can I say this? There was so much pressure to deliver
right.
that everything lost its essence.
Right.
Because people started micromanaging everything.
Right.
And all the fun went out of it.
Right.
Another thing was, I think that the director, who is actually a good guy, he just was inexperienced, he got steamrolled over.
Oh, right.
And then lastly, there was this huge smear campaign that occurred at the release of the movie where people started coming out and speaking out, being vocal about Mike Myers and speaking out against him.
Right. It
was like a 4-page spread in Newsweek.
Why was that? I don't remember.
I think that, you know, supposedly there was this history of bad blood between him and a few people that he had worked with.
Uh-huh.
I really try to not stay as far out of that shit as possible because for me, I got to work with a genius and I've never been an actor who's been like, oh, you have to strike when the iron's hot. Yeah. I don't believe in that.
Yeah.
And the, you know, I really have to do it my way and it's probably to my demise. And then the other part of it is that I've gained so much artistic integrity from being in the presence of people like him and Mary Louise Parker, you know, that it was worth every penny for me. I don't really care if a movie, I get everything I'm going to get out of the movie while we're making the movie.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. I don't look and go, oh, our movie's going to do 30 million this weekend. That's not me.
But it did.
It did.
You had something to do with it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you know, it's true. I know.
And Kevin's a great guy.
Dude.
You know, it's like, you know, I never, like, I've had him in here, and it's just like, the guy fought the fight, you know, he came out on top. He's incredibly grateful. Yep. He's generous.
Yep.
You know, incredibly. I mean, you know, it's got to be about 80% of his success because he's got a good heart. And he does the right thing by people.
He really does. He does the right thing by people. I'm doing my own movie now. He signed on to play a role in it.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's that dude.
Yeah.
He's like, man, I owe you, Rom. I got you. How many days do you need? The busiest man in Hollywood. Yeah. Got to be one of the busiest comedians in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I owe you. How many days do you need? When he said that to me, it took me at least 4 minutes to respond because I couldn't. My movie? You sure? Because, hey, I was literally doing that for like 4 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, he is a generous guy, man.
What, now, this is interesting because we talked a little earlier about, you know, the movies you want to make. Now, this is your movie. Now, yes. We talked earlier about, you know, some of the things that you want to give back to the community.
Absolutely.
Is this one of those projects?
This is one of those projects where it's like, you know, for me, the situation is that in the world of Hollywood, they tend to make you either or.
Yeah.
So you're either this or you're that. So my experience growing, you're either an angel or the devil.
Right.
You're either a whore or a virgin. Very binary way of thinking.
Sure.
And so I have a problem with that because I've grown up with people who were heavily flawed with the best of intentions and gave the best advice they knew how.
Yeah.
And these people aren't depicted in film anymore.
Yeah.
You're either one or the other. The right. films that I grew up watching, that was that. So one of my favorite films of all time, ever since I was a kid, was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Sure.
Now you could look at Jack's character on a lot of different levels. Yeah. You can look at him as crazy. You can look at him as rebellious and obnoxious. You can look at him as a hero.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Leading the frontier or pioneering the frontier. You can look at a lot of those characters in a lot of different ways. And I love that where you're actually engaging the gray area. And I feel like with the dumbing down of a lot of film, because of the fact that we're not even making film we're making film for non-English speaking people.
Right.
If you go to France, they have some of the most sophisticated films that you've ever seen.
Yeah.
But if we're trying to make a movie that's accepted over there, we got to have explosions and shit.
And,
exactly. Because we don't know the intricacies and the idioms
that's
of their
interesting.
Culture.
The international market has made it, broken it down to the lowest common denominator.
Well, only because we're catering to, in my opinion, some of the most sophisticated films I've ever seen have been made in the international market.
Uh-huh.
my personal taste.
Sure.
You know, but at the same time, when we're raising all our money to make our movies, we're raising the money overseas, 90% of it. Okay, I'm just say this for those who aren't aware. I'm speaking the obvious here, but just for those who aren't aware, the way that it works these days is this: if a comedy costs more than $30 million, it's probably not getting made.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else, if you're going to make a film, you're usually going to want to make it in the $100 million and up range, which is basically you're making four quadrant movies at that point, where it appeals to the broadest audience possible. I think Michael Igor or something like that made that announcement when The Proposal was so successful. They said we'd make another one. He was like, no, we're not making a follow-up. I don't care if it made $140 million because it's going to cost us $70 million to make it. And by the time we spend that $70 million and we do the P&A budget, we're not going to recoup on that. Mm-hmm. So if a comedy isn't under $30 million, we ain't making it. Mm-hmm. I think it was Michael. He was the guy who said that shit, right? Okay, cool. So now everyone's jumping on that bandwagon to try to keep the comedies. But the thing is that comedies, like you think of Woody Allen and whatnot, they were very specific to our culture.
Right.
And so that type of stuff these days doesn't translate as well overseas.
Right.
You know,
so you're making it for a niche market, so you got to keep it like at a million, 2 million.
Exactly. So what's happening with film these days is 90% of the money's being raised in foreign markets.
Right.
So we're here in America trying to make money, but in order to get that money, you have to put people in your film that sell overseas.
Right.
So in order to do that, you now have to make a movie that appeals to that market.
Yeah,
and if you're an American making that movie and you're hoping to get some type of domestic gross, you're really kind of making a movie for non-English speaking people, and as a result of that, you're going to go for the explosions.
But okay, so you've put together money,
yeah,
that you got domestically,
and
you've got Kevin Hart committed to it,
yeah,
and it's a story of a flawed protagonist.
Yes, exactly.
And yeah. And you hope that it'll speak to who?
Ultimately, what I want to do is
it's a comedy.
I want to, exactly. It's a dark comedy.
And you wrote it?
I wrote it myself. Been writing it for a while. And what I want to do is I basically want to start reintroducing the idea of the gray area in a movie.
Yeah, no, I think the 70s did that, and then we kind of lost. I mean, Cuckoo's Nest is a good example of that, but
yes,
a lot of those movies where you have an anti-hero or someone you don't know how to feel about.
Exactly.
Because they don't have all the heroic attributes.
Yes, Cable did it so well with Breaking Bad and Damages.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I didn't know if Glenn Close was the good guy or the bad guy.
Yeah, yeah.
What is she doing?
Even The Sopranos.
The Sopranos.
Learned to love that family.
Thank you. Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm working toward introducing that and just basically passing on a message in the movie, which is about how many of us are actually out there asking people to make sacrifices for us that we're not willing to make for ourselves.
Mm.
And it's also about letting go.
Mm-hmm.
It's about letting go of the things.
And where are we in production?
Where are we in production on this? We are literally just closing up. We're closing up the deals right this second. This week, we will have closed the deals with our attached talent.
That sounds great, man.
It is. It is. It's a great opportunity for me because I don't know why. You know, I think I was a lot angrier before in my younger years, but I never really got the calls that I thought I would get. I never really got invited to play with a lot of these, you know, other movies that had occurred. I never really was. I didn't start being asked to be a lead until recently, like over the last year and a half.
How old are you?
I'm 45. And so, you know, and
you
I was
look good though. You look 35.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. Thank you, dude. You know,
that's Trinidad.
Oh, that's Trinidad, and you gotta avoid sugar.
Okay.
Bread, rice, pasta, all that shit is sugar. I don't care what you say. If it creates an insulin spike, it's sugar.
And that's gonna make you old.
Yeah. Well, what happens is like, you know, your cells become resistant because it doesn't want to be poisoned by the insulin.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's called AGE is the process where all these remnants of sugar attach themselves to your cells and you know, the walls of your cells, and then as a result of that, you lose the elasticity in them, and so I'm telling you, I stopped eating sugar for 5 years.
No more cake, no more ice cream.
No, you know, in moderation.
Okay.
But the thing is that what we don't realize is that we're living extreme, and then we want to go from extreme to moderate. No. You got to go from one extreme to the next, and then you got to work your way back to moderate.
All right. Well, tell me about Tijuana Jackson.
Oh, Tijuana Jackson. He's an ex-convict turned motivational speaker that I created. And, you know, Mike Myers really helped influence that as well. I've been doing him for like 13 years.
Doing him where?
I just doing him for my friends.
Oh,
and
okay.
Then a few years ago, I put him on the internet, and that was all she wrote.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's this dude who is flawed. Again, the gray area. He's heavily flawed.
Yeah.
He'll be smoking a cigarette and preaching about health at the same time.
Sure. Yeah.
And he's got these interesting quotes where he's like, you know, He's like life coach with a goon hand, you know, and he'll be like, you know, life is like a vending machine. You know what I'm saying? It's full of change. You know, that type of shit. He thinks he's really proud of himself. You know what I mean? Early bird gets the worm. Early hawk get to eat both them bitches. Heard me?
So that's on YouTube?
It's on YouTube. You look up Tijuana Jackson, and if you are not entertained, my name is not Romany Malco.
It was great talking to you, man.
Yeah, you too, man. Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of
you. I know, ran into you on the plane.
And I geeked the fuck out.
Yeah, you're right? Man, we're going to do it.
Yeah, I geeked out a little bit. You've had some great interviews on here, man.
Oh, thanks. Is your pop still alive?
My dad passed away in 2008.
And your mom?
My mom is still alive. I just went to go see her. I just got back yesterday. I flew back for this interview.
Was your pop able to see some of your success? Or?
My dad was. My dad came with me to the premiere of 40 Year Old Virgin. Funny shit. So my dad comes with me to the premiere of 40 Year Old Virgin.
Yeah.
You know Jerry Bednob?
Yes.
The guy who played the Indian guy that I've been feuding
him
with?
For years, yeah.
He looks at my dad, and my dad looks at him, and they, what the fuck you doing here, boy? Turns out that they knew each other.
From Trinidad? Get out of here.
Yeah, that was great. We had a great night.
That's hilarious.
Him and my dad got shit-faced that night.
That's sweet, man. Well, thanks for talking, and good luck with everything. I'm glad everything's going so well.
Man, thank you very much, man. Hit a boy up on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever the fuck.
Great talk, right? Was I lying? I was not. And since I last talked to you, my jeans are a little more broken in. I imagine that my junk is healing. And I'm sharing too much. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Check the schedule. Get that app for free. Upgrade to the premium. You can stream all 400 episodals. I haven't seen Def Black Cat in a few days, but I don't know. Maybe he'll check in. Everything's all right. As I said, I am in Bloomington, Indiana tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday. And if you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Moin, wir sind die Footballerei. Ich bin Kutsche.
Ich bin Flo.
Und ich bin Daniel.
Wir sind aber noch viele mehr. In der Footballerei gibt es American Football Freischnauze, überwiegend die NFL, in ganz vielen verschiedenen Formaten. Da ist für alle was dabei.
Das Frühstücksei zum Beispiel gibt es jeden Montag ab 5 Uhr als Podcast. In der Saison natürlich mit den ersten Reaktionen auf die Spiele des Wochenendes und in der Offseason versorgen wir dich hier mit allen frischen News aus dem NFL-Kosmos.
Dazu gibt es die bunte Welt der NFL in Kutsches Zirkus, hochspannende Kriminalfälle bei Hall of Crime und das Thema der Woche während der Saison in der Footballerei. Show.
Also, wenn dich American Football fasziniert, wirst du die große Auswahl in der Footballerei lieben. Wir freuen uns auf dich.